You're listening to a Bellingcat Discord server stage talk titled Publishing on Closed Messaging Platforms. This week, we were joined on stage by Sifo Kings from the African journal, The Continent. The Continent specializes in distribution on WhatsApp, Signal, and other encrypted messaging social spaces. In the talk, we explored The Continent's model, how it was set up to function and engage with its audience, and what concerns arise from publishing on these platforms. We also spoke about covering African stories, as The Continent prides itself on covering as many African countries as possible, and how these platforms may give benefits to those trying to circumvent government censorship controls. You can find links to the organization in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday the 9th of May, in the Bellingcat Discord server. Okay. All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome. Today, we're going to be talking about closed messaging platforms like WhatsApp, exploring the benefits and limitations to providing news or research on these types of platforms. We're joined by the amazing Sifo Kings, co-founder and director of The Continent. The Continent is an award-winning journal distributed weekly to audiences covering 54 different countries. The small team behind the publication is made up of African journalists, photographers, and illustrators. And each issue, in my opinion, is beautifully designed, covering an array of different investigative and human-centric stories. What is really unique about The Continent, and hopefully something that we can learn from today, is that they design it purposely to be distributed on WhatsApp. Previously, Sifo was an investigative environmental reporter at South Africa's Mail and Guardian. Today, he's going to be speaking on the formation of the journal, its impact, and why they chose to distribute on closed messaging platforms. As I mentioned just a second ago, we'll have time for a Q&A. To ask a question, please write it in the chat, and I'll read your question out in the Q&A section. Okay. Please label in your question if you do not want me to read out your name for privacy reasons, and I will make sure to not mention who asked the question. But first, Sifo is going to talk for a few minutes about his publication. So Sifo, please take the stage and I will mute myself now.
Thank you, Charlotte. It's really lovely to be here. I remember when a few years into my journalism career in 2014, seeing the big investigation Bellingcat was doing about the airliner that was shot down. Being here is one of the things where you pinch yourself. You're like, hello to everyone here. And hello to everyone listening to us in the future. And I think maybe Kerry from our office, who said she was going to come along and make sure she could report back to everyone else that I did a good job. Let's see how that goes. So as Charlotte said, I'm Sipa, and I'm the publisher of The Continent. It's a weekly African newspaper that comes out on encrypted chat platforms like WhatsApp. It comes out every week. It's made by African journalists. Two-thirds of our audience is African, and I know that in the channel about sub-Saharan Africa here, someone said that most people in the West are uninterested in what's happening on the continent. And what's really nice about our newspaper is a third of our readers are everywhere else in the world. So there are a lot of people who are interested in African journalism, African stories, everything else African. Myself, put some background for you. So I was born in Eswatini. It was then Swaziland, known as Swaziland. I grew up in Botswana, started my journalism career in South Africa. And in my very first job, I was an intern at the Mail and Guardian in South Africa. And because of the places I grew up in, I was really interested on all of this, the point where human beings, industry, and nature meet, right? Because it's all as the industry and the money that wins, right? And communities get destroyed and life is miserable as a result. And that plays a lot into South Africa's story of apartheid, colonialism, extractive industries, and the way things are still continuing. And I spent quite a few years doing that kind of journalism. It was really interesting, really intriguing. I was good at it. But the whole time, there was this sort of layer above me of working in a news industry that wasn't well managed. And as a shop steward, as a union person, I'd always be sitting across from the table from someone in a suit having negotiation about, let's try and save some jobs. Why are sub-editors important? Why is good storytelling important? And I decided after doing a fellowship in the United States to focus on that. So how can we do better management? How can I help do better management? How can I create spaces for other people to do their best work? And that culminated when COVID came along, those good old days of 2020. The newsroom where I worked, a lot of things fell apart. The financial model collapsed and staff elected me to run the newsroom, which was exhausting and all-consuming. And at the same time, you had this much larger collapse in the African journalism ecosystem. So just before 2020, there was a bit of research done on every single newspaper on the African continent. And 54 countries, 1.3 billion people, there were just 1,300 newspapers, which is nothing. And that was before COVID. We haven't had numbers since then. So a bunch of us who'd been talking about journalism a lot, and you know, we're very nerdy about journalism, and you'd go out for drinks or for coffee, and that's what you talked about is, our industry's collapsing. How do we save it? Thought, there's less and less African journalism. This is a crisis. This is also a chance for us to try and do something, to do a little bit to add more journalism to the world. And all of us had a newspaper background, so print weekly newspaper background. And all of us mostly disliked websites, right? Because we haven't done them well. They're not a great place to go and consume journalism. You keep scrolling to the end of the page and you're like, I don't know enough. People read 15 seconds of a story. Like it, in most cases, it isn't working really well. But we used to have weekly newspapers which curated things, right? You'd open it, you'd sit for half an hour, read stuff. You learn a little bit about lots of different things. You'd have your perspective challenged. And in Zimbabwe, there was a newspaper called 263 Chat, which had taken that and put it in PDF format and was sharing it in WhatsApp in Zimbabwe. And that inspired us to see we could take the strength of newspapers and use WhatsApp, use distribution technology to get news to people, right? And this was also at a time, if you remember, COVID, where like all of us had an uncle or an aunt or a cousin or a wife or husband or whatever who would send you links that they'd seen on WhatsApp going, I know, Bill Gates is trying to inject things into your body, or you need to use ivermectin for cows to save yourself from COVID. So there's a huge amount of misinformation on WhatsApp and other platforms, and there wasn't news because publishers were just avoiding WhatsApp because there's so little data there, right? We thought, it is where people live, right? So on the African continent, it's where people do business. It's where people chat to their family. It's where they find out what's happening at church on Sunday. It's where so much of the continent is organized and there isn't news there. That's why we chose that platform. And then we chose the PDF option to put news into there. And Charlotte, you mentioned how beautiful the design is. So it is like an old school newspaper. You can search for it, The Continent, and you can download a PDF of it. We have about 30 pages every single week. Each one is a page. And on any one page, there are no more than 300 words. Most stories are 300 words or 600 words. And most journalists don't like being edited down to that length. I mean, we edit each other. And I've written beautiful 1,000-word stories that I send off to our editor. And then he viciously cuts down to the right length to make it really interesting, really readable. And then we put it on a page and make it look beautiful. And what's nice about that is in the olden days when people made news PDFs, they take the PDF that they sent to the publishers and then they throw it onto, you'd get it on an email and you'd read it on your iPad. With this, because we shrink it down and we build it for smartphones, it means when you open your phone, there's the whole story and you don't have to do that thing of like pinching and kind of look inside or make embiggen, that's a word, the story. So you can open up, there's 30 pages, you read it, there's a bit of news, from across the entire continent. And at the end of it, you can close it and know you've done reading for that week. Like you've caught up. You can always read more. But you don't have to have that dread that we all have of, I don't know enough about the world. When's the next push notification? Let me go back to the website and like refresh it to see what's happening. All of that is done by a team of 6 full-time people, 5 part-time people who edit the stories, lay it out, and send it out to people. Because the model we chose was instead of having full-time reporters who we then parachute into places, we work with local freelancers. Because these are the people who know where they work, they know the stories of that place, and they know how the storytelling in that place works. And we worked with 400 different freelancers in our 4 years and 2 weeks of existence. And these are people in the whole continent. I mean, we have a little list of countries we haven't reported on. So like the Comoros, the little ones where like, we need to get there. We want a story from there. We want a subscriber from there. We want to be there. To Charlotte, your question about publishing on these platforms and publishing in an encrypted ecosystem. We chose WhatsApp because that's where everyone is on the continent. And at the moment, 40% of our subscribers are on WhatsApp, 40% are on email, like old school. And then 10% on Telegram, 10% on Signal, give or take. And in the very beginning, we created this PDF and we just sent it to a couple of dozen people that we thought would be really interested in it. It was entirely an experiment. One of our co-founders, Simon, his mother was helping to edit the newspaper. We didn't have a plan for this to be a media business or take over the world or anything else at that time. Now we do. And those dozen people, a couple of dozen people, we just said, if you appreciate this, please share it with someone that you think will appreciate it. And in the 4 years, we've grown to 21,000 subscribers just through word of mouth. So we haven't had any advertising, socials. We're not competing in with someone else's algorithm to see if your story SOE is good enough to get put in front of whatever people. We're just saying, if you like this journalism, share it. And that's been a beautiful community because we'll often, like so many of the people who read the content aren't subscribers, which also drives us crazy. But you'll go to places and all over the world and you'll meet someone who's like, oh, I saw it. I read the content. I got it from a friend. I got it from whoever. And then you're like, could you please subscribe so we can actually count you in our numbers and count you as a human being? And that's WhatsApp. Signal we created, I don't know if you all remember when Meta bought WhatsApp and then they changed their privacy settings. And a lot of people left WhatsApp because they didn't want to hand over that much data. We stayed because, again, it's where everyone is. But people asked us to create a Signal channel. So we're like, okay. We created a Signal channel. And much like WhatsApp in the very beginning, it's such a manual process. So to go back to WhatsApp, when we started, we just had 2 people, Kiri and Dumi, who would take the newspaper and then copy and paste it and send it to people. And often people would say, what technology are you using? What is your distribution platform? It was just like a human is sending it and dealing with people's queries and complaints. And one of the nice things about that has been people actually talk to you then, like on WhatsApp and on Signal. And like Kiri has given people IT advice. People will contact her and say, I can't download the PDF. It won't fit on my phone or something. And then she sits there and she painstakingly helps people with their IT and other things. We've also had people send us accidentally, apparently, naked pictures on WhatsApp. It's a lovely thing. We are out there in the world where our readers are and working with them. the downside of it came a couple of years ago with WhatsApp, when we started noticing that people weren't getting our newspaper and or it would be delayed. And Meta, WhatsApp never said anything to us. It was only through this word of mouth. And we went back and forth and had many conversations with WhatsApp business and other things. And basically, if you get to a certain point, they treat you as spam. And your trust ratings go down for all the obvious reasons. And we ended up having to pay an American company, Twilio, who then certify you as like the legit business who can then work on WhatsApp. And we worked with a local company in South Africa to create an automatic distribution platform. Now on WhatsApp, it's expensive, but we can put the PDF into a system and it sends it to all our readers, which is nice because we can scale and Kiri doesn't have to stay up until 5 a.m. copy-pasting and sending the newspaper to people. One of the things about that experience is just how much of what we're doing at scale, covering a continent in this new kind of way of doing journalism, is trial and error. So other people aren't doing it at this scale. The platform's obviously hostile to journalism. And also a physical PDF, like an actual PDF, very few people share them, right? It's a strange thing to send out to other people. So a lot of our work is sort of like proselytizing about newspapers, the PDF, print newspapers, and journalism. And while all of this is funded and we have funding for next year, so we are alive in an age of terrifying times in journalism, a lot of our funders have been taught that a website, a newspaper has 1 million readers. We have these massive inflated numbers, which don't actually say that someone's actually reading it. It's just a big number. So we've had funders say, why do you have so small an audience? And because we don't have a news website, one funder recently said to us, no one takes you seriously, or people I speak to don't take you seriously in the funding world because you don't have a website. Like, you're not real. We're like, but we are here. There's a newspaper and everyone reads it. So there's a lot of teaching and communication about trying out this new method and showing that you can do old school and new school, marry them together and make better kind of journalism. And I don't know, it's exhausting. At the very moment, I'm in the middle of a donor application for funding that has made my brain melt. And you know, when you can't find the right kind of music or soundtrack to help your brain work, and you're just like never in the zone, that's where I'm with that. But it is really interesting and exciting, right? Because let's be honest, like, journalism is the depressing place to be and work, and so much is going wrong. But because we're experimenting and trying new things, we also get to meet with lots of people who are problem solving and doing journalism, doing storytelling, and trying little bits to make journalism better. Over to questions.
Thank you so much for such an insightful run through of your organization. It definitely is a unique model, and I've worked in newsrooms before that only published on social media and didn't have a website, and I've had those conversations with funders as well previously myself, so I know how frustrating they can be. So just to clarify, I was going to ask, in terms of your funding model, What does it look like? Is it only based on funders? Because a lot of the people in this audience, for example, might be inspired by what you do and might want a little bit more insight into how they could possibly set up a similar model in their respective countries. Is it solely based on donations? How did you kind of set it up financially? Because subscriptions, right, are free for anybody who is subscribing.
Yes, key question, because we decided it has to be free, because so many of the places we're trying to get the journalism to, there isn't other journalism or there isn't quality journalism for all of the reasons in the world. And one of the things we do at the PDF is keep it at about 11 megabytes, because the other constraint is data. data is so expensive in a lot of African countries. So for us, people are paying with data to get to it. When we think about like a value transaction, yes, it's free. And to date, it has all been philanthropic funding, people coming to us to support that journalism. We've run advertising in the past. And for our very first advertising campaign, we ran an old school advert, Age in the Newspaper, which was just an advert. We asked our readers if they'd be okay with that. It gauged the mood, and people were like, yes, journalism is expensive. We're like, oh, cool. You also understand the struggles of this whole thing. We are going to start doing more of that advertising, and not ethical, good advertising. None of this stuff in the gray areas that tries to mislead readers. And we're also looking at events and all the other things you can do to bring in income. What we haven't done is ask people to support us or give us money in that kind of way. People can donate money to us, and lots of people have. We decided not to make that like a business ask for people, because that big ask of readers is, please share the newspaper. Like, grow the community. That's valuable to us. And we're lucky. We're lucky that at the moment we're interesting enough and doing important enough work that people support us. And I know it's really hard to raise funds.
Definitely, definitely. Just in the vein of starting up a similar model, you mentioned in the beginning the fact that you had to think about word counts all of a sudden, and you've just mentioned data as well. What were some other constraints or considerations that you had to make when first thinking about publishing on WhatsApp primarily, and then perhaps you also had to think of additional things when it came to expanding onto Signal, for example? And what were some of the kind of building blocks that you had to put in place that you wouldn't necessarily have to think about for a website publication, for example?
So in the beginning, because it was copy-paste, the biggest consideration for us was just a human being with time and how to pay that person, two people, to spend the time to copy-paste the newspaper across. So at the moment, it costs us $1,000 in addition to distribute on WhatsApp, because we have to pay the American service provider and then the local partner that we have. And that was obviously a huge cost that we hadn't planned for. So again, money. Money is always the big barrier. In terms of being a startup, like in an African context, so we're based in South Africa because South Africa has excellent media laws. It's very hard to sue a publication. And there's reasonable defense. There's like defense against slap suits. So it's a lot better legal environment than, say, the UK. It's a great enabling environment. But moving money out of South Africa, and because we have freelancers across the whole continent, it is a nightmare to pay people. And our pledge that we achieve basically every single time is that we pay people within a week of them invoicing us. But like trying to pay someone in Ethiopia when the Ethiopian government doesn't want people to get dollars, say, or in Ghana, is the biggest challenge of what we do, probably. Like, journalism is difficult, commissioning stories is difficult, but running a business and moving money is quite a thing. I think if you're starting out, I was doing a journalism course, and there was a group of founders, and they were talking about who are the first five hires that you should make as a new news publication. And all of ours were editorial. There were people who made journalism and got it to people. And in this room, they were like, someone who gets you money, someone who manages money. I was like, ha, that's useful in hindsight. And I think that's something to definitely think about if you're creating a new publication, having those roles, because obviously those people then get you more money or raise more money, and it pays off. But we were journalists and we were obsessed with journalism. We were like, it's a crisis. Let's try and solve it just by doing stories.
Yeah, you tend to think about the partnering with other journalists, but sometimes it can be really, really important to look at other areas as well of your newsroom to kind of make it sufficient. We've had loads of questions and something that I wanted to ask as well about the nature of WhatsApp and Signal and closed messaging platforms in terms of the way that they, as you mentioned at the beginning, can be quite a hotbed for disinformation and fake news. And Cram Magica has asked, are you concerned malicious actors could replicate and share a form of your PDFs, but with false information? Has it happened before? How do you kind of navigate the disinformation that you can find on closed messaging apps, particularly because it's potentially more difficult to kind of control where that disinformation goes?
So this is a nightmare that I had maybe 2 months ago. I woke up and I was like, I'd watch something or read a book. And like, yeah, someone edits our PDF. And once we, for me, it was a kind of, we'll know we made it when people think they need to manipulate this to start affecting change or doing bad things. And it is something we're looking at now on like how to, because you can lock PDFs and do things to them to stop people being able to edit them to a certain level, like very basic actors. And we need to do that. I mean, there's not much you can do about like state level actors with fast resources interfering and messing with your journalism. So we act in good faith and do journalism and send it out to the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem that every newsroom is really thinking about. I mean, Bellingcat ourselves have been subjected to impersonation campaigns on Twitter recently, or X, as we should call it now, and other platforms as well. And we found that those originated on Telegram. So we're very familiar with those kinds of impersonations. No, we're not calling it X, someone put it in the chat. But yeah, I think it's something that a lot of people are concerned about when publishing on closed messaging platforms, that they can't control where their stories go or where their research goes. Is there an ability at all? How do you kind of monitor your audience and the impact your stories or your newspaper has? Kind of how do you monitor that? Is it just through the subscriber base? Or is there a way to kind of track how many times it's been shared and things like that? You mentioned that WhatsApp flagged you as spam as well. Do you collect that kind of data internally in-house?
So on Telegram, we have a broadcast list, and Telegram is really good at giving you as much data as you can imagine about who saw it, when people saw it, everything else. Obviously, the rest of Telegram is an interesting, questionable ecosystem. But we broadcast there. Signal, you get no data at all. I mean, now you don't even get names. People don't want to share them. So that we sort of do as a public service. We publish to about 1,000 people on Signal. They get the newspaper. And it means, you know, if you're in a country where just reading news can be used against you, they're safe. WhatsApp, we have to all sorts of different people, like approach them from different angles to see if we can get more data. Obviously, Meta don't like publishers and being seen as a publisher. But we have gotten to the point at WhatsApp where they have said to us, even with the best will in the world, they wouldn't be able to track what happens with a PDF. So if I share it with you, this is what they say. They can't see who you shared it with, that particular PDF. So there's no way to track that network of how the newspaper goes. What we have done is then in our reader surveys, we asked people, do you share it? If you share it, how many people with? What kind of places do you share it? And we use that information to create like a sense of how the newspaper spreads. And with that, we think the 21,000 subscribers lead to about 100,000 people seeing the newspaper every week. But again, and this is something, you know, looking at funders and advertisers, it is really difficult because you are publishing into an ecosystem that you then have no insight into. But it's really important to publish there because there's so much disinformation there. And if you can put good stuff in there, you're helping.
Can it also be quite freeing to publish on those kinds of platforms in regards to kind of content moderation concerns on other social platforms and also kind of censorship as well if you're working across country lines? Is closed messaging platforms a space that is a little bit freeing in that sense, from your opinion?
It is one of the real advantages of working on closed messaging platforms. So, for example, during COVID in Tanzania, the president didn't believe in COVID, and the media in that country were too afraid to report on the fact that hospitals were filling up with people. So we got a journalist to go to hospitals and, you know, just record the fact that people were dying of COVID. And we did an edition about that, which also was translated into Kiswahili. And that anecdotally went viral in Tanzania. And that's the power of that, right? Because the government can't stop that. It can't shut down a website. In Eswatini, for example, the king has an agreement with the cell phone providers where, and this is in many places, shut down the internet or shut down access to things. But you can't, you can shut down WhatsApp. But one of the lovely things about a PDF is you can share it offline. You can stick it on a USB stick and share it with people, which is a real power that we have. And is one of the other reasons that we stick to WhatsApp and those encrypted chat platforms. And no one can stop us getting through it to people. And that's a very rare thing, because in our experience, especially at a local level, in most of the countries we work in, journalists don't feel like they can publish the stories they'd like to publish, right? The really good journalists. Because there are consequences for them, or there's self-censorship, or there's laws, or just violence towards journalists. So those people can give us the stories or work for us, and then we can publish them and they go back into the country.
Yeah, it's kind of empowering that you're kind of, you haven't got this kind of watching eye that can control a little bit about what you can kind of distribute to the world, which is really amazing. We've had actually quite a few questions on African stories and the things that are missing in terms of techniques that people suggest may not be as widely used. So Eridace has said, question here, what are the initiatives to spread the use of open source research techniques within Africa, especially for countries that can face major difficulties to conduct it due to low internet usage penetration or high cloud coverage? Can you speak to that at all? Do you have any experience in knowing if there's initiatives to drive people to use kind of open source methods on the continent? And if not, has there been more of a drive towards investigative stories on the continent over recent years?
I can't speak to that specific thing because it isn't an area of expertise of mine. When it comes to investigations, it's such a mixed bag, but because investigations are the one thing that'll get funding, right? So you have a lot of, you can get funding for dedicated investigative journalism outlet, where you wouldn't be able to get funding for a news publication. That's what people are interested in. And there's some incredible investigative units across the continent and people just doing insane work, regardless of the consequences in their own health and safety. And we're trying to partner with more and more of those people. So there's a lot of that happening, but it's tiny drops. Like the big picture is journalism is virtually gone in most markets. And journalism about regions or the whole continent is now non-existent. And you're relying on the BBC or Voice of America, who are outside perspectives and everything else coming in. So yes, there's little bits of hope, but the big picture is devastatingly sad.
Yeah, I would just shout out some investigative platforms that I've personally worked with. So Oxpeckers is a fantastic African investigative environmental journalism unit. They use a lot of kind of satellite footage, satellite analysis and data analysis, geomapping,
stuff that most people in this space would be very familiar with, to cover environmental stories on the continent. Code Africa obviously is doing a lot of work training people up in data and training the next generation of developers as well, which is also super useful in terms of open source research. So there's some fantastic organizations doing amazing work on the continent. And again, Africa is not the only region, only large region of the world that has internet issues, and many others manage to do kind of open source reporting. We've actually had a question again on this. Has there been challenges in cross-cultural communication that affect funding or content? And have you also had to consider language options, particularly as you're kind of reporting on 54 different countries? Have you had to think about where that might be shared to and how you manage language difficulties as well?
Yes, I mean, this is incredibly difficult because you are operating at such a scale. I mean, when we sit down and think about how absurdly ambitious project is, make you panic. At the very basic, what we do is ensure that you have a newsroom that represents the content you report on, and that you keep working to make that better, right? So you have a diversity in your newsroom. So when it comes to any kind of story, a discussion about a story, you have different perspectives, and you can, people feel that they can argue about things and discuss things. And we try that as well with all the freelancers we work with. So, I mean, this week we had a conversation in our newsroom about a story we'd done about the election in Senegal. So the new president, everyone's excited about, but he's appointed a cabinet with just four women in it out of 24, 25 ministers. And in Senegal, media don't feel like they're in a position to question that and do honest reporting about it, or tough reporting about it. But we did. And we had a whole conversation in our newsroom because the reporter who'd written the story said, in the Senegalese context, what you did was very like grim. Like, you called it out. You said, this thing is, and maybe we would have done it in a more polite way or like an understated way. Because our culture of storytelling is very blunt, very to the point, very honest. That doesn't work in local contexts. So we're always trying to balance that continental context and the audience we have with local sensitivities. And it's wildly difficult. In Ghana, Ghana's passed through a lot of laws against LGBTQI people, and a lot of journalists in that country have helped push those laws and seem to hate anyone who isn't straight. And those are the kind, you know, if you're working with local reporters, that is their worldview, and that informs their reporting. And you're coming with your worldview and saying, well, you need to sign up or agree to thoughts that you should care about other human beings. So it's always a balancing act. And it's informed by just talking to people and listening. Like, we are going to make mistakes. We do make mistakes. You have to be okay with that and listen to people as you go along. In terms of languages, in the past, we've translated stories. So we've done Kiswahili, French, Portuguese, all the colonizer languages. We have thought about doing different language editions. And I know a lot of websites will use Google Translate or, you know, just do rough translations. But storytelling is so different in different cultures. So like West African French is vastly different from French in France, right? And the way of storytelling. So if you were to create like a different edition of the continent in one of those languages, you'd need to create an entire newsroom that has an editor to give the cultural context of that language in that region. And that's a huge project. And there's a reason that almost no publications with like French-English divide. And with reporters, almost all the people that we work with are reporting in a third or fourth language. So it takes a lot more effort to work with them and edit stories and help them. But that is the reality of where we work. And it's really impressive that people are writing stories in their third and fourth language. We know people who have now started using AI help them translate stories and get stories to us. So it is the technology to help people. There's good and bad of technology. And our core thing is speak to those reporters, speak to that audience, understand people, and talk about it so you can make better decisions.
Thanks so much. Keep the questions coming. We've got about 20 minutes left. The person who asked that question is so insightful. I'm obsessed with this and how much your newsroom is thinking about it. Thank you. That's great. We've had a couple of other questions in about your experience of African journalism. So someone's asked, given that you've known firsthand what the sphere of African journalism is, what main schisms do you see in terms of what is happening on the ground versus how Western legacy media likes to cover things? And to the extent that there is a massive difference, how do you think Western reporting harms open source research or investigative journalism?
Our thought process is the world is better when there's more journalism, right? So it's really important to have, say, the BBC or CNN who can come in with their access and their perspective and do stories. You also then need local journalism. So as much as you need like the continent to do big continental stories and local stories, you need local journalists to do their thing, because at the moment, because we have so little journalism and a lot of that is coming from the outside, you end up just having the highlight stories, the stories that people pay attention to because we're competing in to defeat algorithms, or because SOE will rank your story better. So what you tend to do see, and there's research from places now starting to look at, like quantify this, where the vast majority of stories about African countries only happen when things are bad, right? There's a coup or there's a flood or insert generic bad thing. And local media do that as well. Because again, we're, if it bleeds, it leads. That attitude still lasts. And the algorithms have hard-coded that. What we try and do is just do stories about life, right? And have complexity in the story. So for this week, we're doing a story about Lake Malawi, which is beautiful. It's a tourist destination. We love travel stories. But the story is about how, because of climate change, it's being destroyed, right? We have lovely pictures of Lake Malawi. We have the story of the tourism. And it's the thing of introducing nuance and complexity to all the journalism we do. Even 300 words, right? You can have that nuance and complexity. So it'd be nice to see more of that in international publications and local publications and everyone else. Like more storytelling, like we do when we speak to each other. It's more nuance, it's more complexity to it. Instead of just, here's an inverted pyramid, bang, people are dead.
At Perugia, the International Center, International Journalism Festival, you were part of a panel speaking about good news from the continent. And I really encourage people to go listen to that. I'll find the link and put it in the chat if you have time later today. It's a really interesting discussion. Somebody asked in the chat how to access your publication. I've just referred them to the website where there's a link to subscribe to the WhatsApp channel. As forementioned, it's important you subscribe so you're part of the audience numbers, but it is free to subscribe. River N has asked, you mentioned the current breakdown of readership, 2/3 African audience and 1/3 international audience, if I recall correctly. Would you be aiming for the readership to be any different, either higher percentage of African readership or higher percentage of international? And would you change things on the editorial side or in the funding model to achieve that?
So I often have conversations with people outside of the continent who say that part of the job we're doing and should do is better educate people everywhere else in the world about Africa, and that we should throw our readership there to help do that. At the same time, like, there's a desperate need in African countries to inform people and get quality journalism to them, and resources are limited. And at a very realistic level, the system that we have, that we pay to send editions on WhatsApp, sending a newspaper to someone in Europe is more expensive than sending a newspaper to someone, say, in Zimbabwe, right? Like by double. So it'll be like 12 US cents to send someone a newspaper in Germany. Germans are our most expensive WhatsApp subscribers. So when you're looking at resource allocation, that then does inform your priorities. So we want everywhere to read us, but our priority is Africans. So if that percentage grew to be more African, we're okay with that. And that's what we say to funders. Like, that is our core audience, is Africans getting in news. Because also, if you live outside of Africa, there's a lot, like, you're well served as a market. Also, but it is an existential conversation that we have often.
Yeah. Also, you know, if just because you live on the African continent doesn't mean that you're familiar with every single country's news as well. It's it's fascinating to read about different countries other than your own. And it's 54 countries. It's a huge amount of news and politics and ongoings that is fascinating to read about. There's not many publications, for example, that cover the entirety of Europe for comparison. And I think it's fascinating that you saw this kind of gap in the market and kind of jumped into it. That being said, I wanted to ask what you thought about the future of media on closed messaging platforms. Do you think the role of closed messaging platforms might evolve in the media landscape of the future? Are you already seeing more publications kind of jumping on the trend that you and Chat263, I think you mentioned, kind of started? And how do you kind of see the continent living in that space? Are you going to continue kind of pushing for these closed messaging platforms? Are you looking to kind of expand elsewhere?
Was it late last year, WhatsApp created communities? News communities? And all the news publishers who have websites jumped on it, because everyone's like, WhatsApp is a giant news audience and people just get through there. And it doesn't seem like anyone has strategy. They're just like, the audience is there, let me share a link. So it'd be interesting to see how that goes. We've stayed away from it because you can't publish a PDF on communities. I think what we are seeing is, and I mean, you see it with the lawsuits in India against WhatsApp, or countries to try and break that encryption and break down these publishing monopolies, or these encrypted chat platform monopolies. But at the moment, in our experience on the African continent, WhatsApp is king, but there isn't an alternative. So what's the Chinese? WeChat made a huge play into the African market, lots of money, and it just didn't get traction because WhatsApp has already won, right? And it works. It's low data. In a lot of countries, you also get it for free. So Meta, Facebook have a free basics program, which will give you access to WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, where you don't pay for the data. So that also captures that market. So WhatsApp will be here for a while for our time horizon. But because we have the PDF, we're always looking at the new place where people are and where people are sharing. That's why we're Signal, Telegram, Blue Sky, all of the, like, we have lots of little other publishing places. So we can move wherever the audience is. But at the moment, we're in a good place.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I mean, the trend previously was everybody needs to jump onto TikTok immediately. And now it seems in my conversations with people, it's everyone needs to jump on Telegram or Signal or WhatsApp immediately and serve people where they are. And I think quite a lot of publications in the regions where audiences are and have been on these closed messaging platforms for a long time have already known this for a long period of time and have been working within those spaces. we used to work in my old publication, we used to work with an organization based in the Philippines who was using Signal groups to push some media literacy initiatives because they knew that was where the audience that they were trying to reach were. It was very difficult, as you mentioned, to track the impact, but it was important because that's where people were communicating and where people were sharing information. And in terms of open source research, Telegram, for example, is one of the first places we jump on at Bellingcat when a breaking news event happens, because that's usually where people are starting to talk and communicate with the first videos that you might find appear on other platforms later on. We've only got time for two last questions, if you're really quick. Somebody's asked a question, but I want to kind of summarize it because it's quite long-winded. But basically, they've asked, it's quite easy to read something like the Democracy Index and see almost all countries in sub-Saharan Africa listed as authoritarian or hybrid regime. But obviously, this misses a very large amount of context. What would you say, as open source researchers or investigative journalists, what we need to know about press and electoral freedoms in the region? I'm perhaps viewing this from a very American-centric lens, but I'm curious as to how these intricacies of government affect what our ideal approach should be. So when you're working with freelancers, for example, how do you kind of navigate the intrinsic, the different government regimes in the country? And does that come into play when you're looking at your stories at all? Is that something that you need to kind of consider with each story that comes in terms of pitches? Or is it something that your newsroom doesn't necessarily have to think about because it's working across so many different countries?
So firstly, our policy is we publish anything, right? So no one can ever stop us publishing a story if it's in the public interest. The only thing that does and has stopped us publishing stories has been safety of the journalist. And as an example, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we had our front cover. We're a newspaper, we get to have covers. Our front cover was a story about a district in Egypt, in Cairo. It's a historic district, and someone's putting a highway through the middle of it. And we had a local journalist do the story. And then we edited the story and added some like perspective or context for people who would not live in Egypt and would benefit from the context. One of that being the country is effectively a military government and there was a coup and the West supports it and sustains it. And a few other bits of context. And the journalist got back to us and said, you can't say that. Like it is, that journalist would be in danger if that story came out. So we edited that story to change that context. So it is always happening. And I think if you're an outside journalist or looking for fixes or newsroom working with people, listen to those reporters. Because often, especially Western publications will say, well, we have to publish this or we have to include this detail. The truth will out. But trust people. Like if a reporter says something to you, trust their instinct and work with them. So that's our policy. These people know the context better than you do. Support them, trust them, do stories. And if American outside publications did that more, we'd end up with better, more nuanced journalism as well.
100%. Yes. I also added in the chat that it, as you mentioned as well, I think in passing, in regards to what you can legally safely publish, it also depends on where you're based as a researcher and where your organization is based as well, making claims about individuals, for example. Finally, and lastly, I wanted to ask if there are any particular publications or any particular models that inspire or interest you that we should also be aware of as audience consumers, but also as journalists, as researchers, as people working within the same space. Is there any other publications that kind of inspire the continent? Because the continent is very inspirational in itself. And I wanted to know what inspires your newsrooms. What are you talking about in your weekly or daily course?
I'm the worst person to remember names and details. I'll meet people and then I'll have to introduce them to someone else and I'll have already forgotten their name. It is an Achilles heel. What I can say is we are constantly, especially in South America and in Southeast Asia, there are lots of publications which are just experimenting with storytelling. And that's what interests us a lot. So like visual storytelling based outlets, obviously TikTok, because a lot of the journalism that happens on TikTok is very much like our print journalism. Short to the point, but really thoughtful storytelling. So that's what we talk about, what we get inspiration from, is how people are crafting stories so people actually take them on board. So a lot of journalism is really very boring and doesn't care about the audience. That's what we obsess about.
Yes, me too. It's definitely the idea of accessible journalism, journalism that is accessible by all and has been created almost for the audience in mind, is something that I think is those publications are the drivers of innovation. And we too work with some incredible Latin American publications, Sarastenta being one of them, Clip being another that we worked with recently. Some really fascinating developments in that space as well. But it is time. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sifa Kings. And thank you so much for talking to us about the continent and how you publish on closed messaging platforms. And for the insights on African publishing as well, the African media landscape in general. Thank you to everyone who has joined in the audience today as well. And if you're listening on the podcast, we will be back in 2 weeks' time with a new stage talk. But for now, thank you so much, Sifa, and have a fantastic day, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the stage talk. If you'd like to catch a stage talk live, where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.